The following Dharma talk was recorded in February 2014 in Kansas City, Kansas. It is one of eight recordings from the retreat called Awakening with Insight, Cultivating Concentration and Mindfulness, taught by Shyla Catherine and Phil Jones. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. Shyla Catherine is the founder of Insight Meditation South Bay in Mountain View, California. She has practiced meditation since 1980 with more than 8 years of accumulated silent retreat experience. Shyla has authored two books, Focused and Fearless, A Meditator's Guide to States of Deep Joy, Calm, and Clarity, and Wisdom Wide and Deep, A Practical Handbook for Mastering Jhana and Vipassana. Find out more about Shyla at www.imsb.org. Phil Jones has been teaching insight meditation since 1996. He has studied with teachers from Spirit Rock and the Insight Meditation Society, and graduated from the first Community Dharma Leader Program in 2000. Phil has served on Mid-America Dharma's Board of Directors since the mid-1990s. Find out more about Phil at www.silentmindopenheart.org.
The title of tonight's talk is Perception, the Concept of Things. What is your concept of spiritual awakening, liberation? Do you have an image of it? Do you have a concept or idea of what it is? Sometimes we hear of these states and we envision what it will be like, what it will feel like, what will be like when we are awakened. As I'm using the term liberation or freedom, I'm referring to something, though, that is not fabricated, is not gained, and really has nothing whatsoever to do with ourselves. It's not something that we can add to life like a spice, and it's not something that will adjust our personalities. It is the ending of greed, of hate, and of delusion. Freedom is known when we stop confusing ourselves. Now, that's a simple statement, but I mean it very profoundly. When we really stop distorting our perception. We all have the potential to live with freedom, with ease, with clarity. And yet so often we just don't perceive things clearly. Instead, we're caught in a pattern that's based in ignorance. And so tonight I want to be looking at perception, but also very much misperception. How accurate is your own perception? Do you believe what you see? Do you believe what you feel? Do you believe what you think? Do you perceive accurately? Or to what extent do you construct an identity around feelings, desires, what we like, what we don't like? Sometimes we find ourselves actually living in something of a fantasy, quite out of touch with the simple experience of what we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, or know. One spiritual teacher, Byron Katie, is famous for asking two simple questions. Is it true? And can you know for sure that it is true? Just very simple questions that are worth asking ourselves again and again every time we have a repeating thought, every time we have a belief, every time we form an opinion or think we know something. Can we ask, is it true? And can I actually know that it is true? So often what we believe doesn't hold up to the investigation of these two simple questions. So in meditation practice, we bring mindfulness to the activity of perception. This is so important that we understand what perception is and how it functions, that the Buddha included it as one of the five aggregates. It's highlighted. There are many other mental factors that are simply included within mental formations. But perception is pulled out as a distinct aggregate, as a distinct category, so that it gets special attention. And so we're encouraged to investigate and to understand how the mind works, how this psychophysical process, when we engage with the sensory data or mental data, when we engage with the mind and body, how it works in contact with that stimulus. In particular, we're understanding how we know things, what is known, and how do we interpret what is known. We might expand this to include how we learn from what we encounter to inform what we know in the next moment. Have you ever noticed that sometimes you have one experience of something and it affects the experience of something similar in the future? It's as though we've learned something from that that almost, it sometimes can inform or can even, if it's extreme, seem to interfere with the possibility of knowing something afresh. Perception is defined as having a function, the function to pick out the distinguishing marks of an experience. Perception gives that experience a name and stores it in memory for future reference. In this way, perception allows us to make sense of the barrage of sensory stimulus that we experience every day. But when there is insufficient mindfulness, then we're going to stay on the superficial level of recognition, just basically recognizing the concept of things, a superficial idea of how things are based upon previous experiences. We might be holding ourselves back from a direct and fresh encounter with what's actually happening in the present moment. Sometimes this can happen for meditators after we've watched one breath and then a second breath and then a third breath and then a fourth breath and 100 breaths and 1,000 breaths and 10,000 breaths. We can get a little disinterested. We've seen it before. We know what it is. It can be a challenge to keep the interest alive in this simple practice of Anapanasati Samadhi. But sometimes we know this not just in the refined states of meditation, but just as we're wandering about our lives. Maybe, oh, there's a beautiful sunset. The sun rises and the sun sets here have just been gorgeous this week. But, you know, seen one, seen them all, right? Just the sun rising, just the sun setting. Sometimes we don't even connect with the experience, and we're only reminded to look again. Maybe if we see somebody else looking at it. This doesn't need to be indulging in the visual sensual pleasures. It's just simply recognizing, noticing the nature around us. Sometimes the factor of perception is easiest to recognize in our misperceptions. And sometimes it's when our perception is obviously wrong, obviously faulty, that we realize, oh, it isn't the way it is, it's a perception. I think there's a long history of comedy being based on misperception. You know, the age-old comedies where the actors are saying something on the stage, and then somebody comes in and hears just the last few words. But those last few words give them an impression of something entirely different than what was being said. And then they misperceive the situation and scurry off and do all kinds of little actions based upon a misunderstanding because of a half-heard sentence. I mean, if you look at the works of Shakespeare, you'll find that it is riddled with a comedy based upon misperception, illuminating how faulty our perceptions and assumptions are, and how much action for in the comedies, the delight and the funny things of lovers confusing who's in love with who, lovers confusing, even, you know, putting there's the one, the 12th night is basically the misperception of gender and love, where the girl puts on men's clothing because it's safer to travel in the countryside alone looking like a boy. They takes on a job with a page who falls in love with another woman, and then they're in love with this and this and this. And the whole misunderstanding is based upon a misperception of gender. And who's the sister of who and the brother of who all gets entangled. But there's also the misperceptions that can happen that are tragedies. And we find those also included in Shakespeare's repertoire. People killed based upon a misunderstanding. In the silence of meditation, though, we'll realize sometimes that we are perceiving something. What are we perceiving? Okay, we're sitting and meditating. Maybe we find ourselves entangled in some kind of expectation for something, a craving, a projection, some kind of attachment. Do we take a moment just to check sometimes and see if those thoughts, if those perceptions are actually accurate in the present situation? It can be humbling to recognize how distorted our perceptions can be, because so often they limit and define and fragment our experience, compartmentalize our experience, make our experience try to conform to a previous concept, and it might be quite removed from what's actually happening if we look closely. So we have the opportunity in meditation to look and see how the mind works, how our perception works, how do we interpret things, how do we relate to things, and how do we conceive of ourselves in relationship to our world. In the Samyutta Nikaya, it says, "What has weighed down everything? What is most extensive? What is the one thing that has everything under its control? Naming has weighed down everything. Nothing is more extensive than naming. Naming is the one thing that has all things under its control." If we take this naming to an extreme, we might sense how distorting it is to project our ideas of something upon the experience, and how that can remove us and prevent us from ever actually experiencing it. We can look at perception as the concept of the perceiver, the perceived, and the perception. We might think of it as the seer, or an assumed self-reference position called the seer. The seen, which is what the object is that we're perceiving, and the seeing, which is the knowing consciousness. And we can investigate each of these aspects of perception because they don't function separately, and yet they're somewhat distinguishable. We might sometimes focus on one aspect more than another. We might focus on the object, such as the sound or the taste, the sight or the breath. What is it that is stimulating the senses? What is the object that is being known? Or we might focus on the sense of subjectivity, on the sense of I arising, the one who is knowing it or having the experience. Or we might cultivate mindfulness of the consciousness of it, that knowing aspect. What is the quality of mind that is knowing the experience? How is that flavored? Is it wholesome? Is it unwholesome? But often when the mindfulness is not clear, then we won't perceive things directly. We'll really just be circling around our assumptions about them, because perception is so easily mediated by our ideas about things, because when we perceive something, our present moment experience meets those previous experiences that were like it, that the previous perception marked for future reference. And so past perceptions condition future perceptions. How do your thoughts influence your feelings? How are your feelings influenced by your desires and your associations, your beliefs or your fears? In beginning meditation classes, students are often quite intrigued and surprised when we work with pain. Because in beginning meditation classes, we ask people to direct their attention to pain, to actually feel it, to become mindful of unpleasant sensation, and to look so closely that we see the diversity of those sensations, the sparks of a tingle, the hardness, the arising and passing of heat or cold, the shivers and the pulsing. All changing sensations. When students start to look closely at what they originally thought of as pain, almost universally they say it was not as bad as they thought. It was not as painful as they feared. It was not solid. And it was not unbearable. The concept of pain breaks down under close examination. And then we simply experience the arising and passing of momentary sensation, free from the weight of this idea that it is pain. The untrained mind, though, quickly jumps on the bandwagon of thought and is usually trapped by its assumptions, and then proliferates out in trains of thought associations that take the mind quite far from the changing nature of present experience. We might habitually construct a sense of self in relationship to the things that we perceive, instead of just letting it rest with mindfulness of perceiving. Do we fabricate a sense of self as the meditator rather than just experience the process of meditation unfolding? Have you experienced simple sensations or events, moments of contact, without embellishing them with the concept of, this is happening to me. I am having this experience. This experience is mine. Without conceiving of the encounter through those lenses of self-reference. In the first discourse, in the middle-length discourses, the root of all things, we have a teaching that describes how an untaught ordinary person experiences something, and then how a practitioner experiences something, someone on the path, and how an awakened one, an arahant, experiences something. The description for the ordinary person says, he perceives the seen as the seen. Having perceived the seen as the seen, he conceives himself as the seen. He conceives himself in the seen. He conceives himself apart from the seen. He conceives the seen to be mine. He delights in the seen. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it. And then it goes through the same paragraph, but the same teaching, but instead of the seen, it goes the heard. And then the whole paragraph is repeated with the sensed and with the cognized. So we have the same teaching repeated for the seen, the heard, the sensed, and the cognized. So again, it's another way of including all of experience, all that is known. So that's the untaught, ordinary person who conceives himself as the seen, in the seen, apart from the seen, or the seen to be mine. Now, a practitioner in training who has not yet reached the goal, but is practicing, how does he approach it? He directly knows the seen is the seen. That's different than the ordinary person who he perceives the seen as the seen. Now the practitioner directly knows the seen as the seen. Having directly known the seen as the seen, he should not conceive himself in the seen. He should not conceive himself apart from the seen. He should not conceive the seen to be mine. Why is that? So that he may fully understand it. So here we have a practitioner who is directly knowing experience and working on this path, working with the clarity of perception. The mind may not yet be free, but it has a clear sense of the goal and has this commitment to directly know, to bring mindfulness to whatever is seen, heard, sensed, or cognized. Why? So that we fully understand it. And then it describes how an arhant with taints destroyed, who has lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden and reached the true goal, destroyed the fetters of being, and is completely liberated through final knowledge. Now, how does this one, this awakened one, experience the seen, the heard, the sensed, and the cognized? He directly knows the seen is the seen. Now, this part's the same as the practitioner, who also directly knows the seen is the seen. Having directly known the seen is the seen, he does not conceive himself in the seen. He does not conceive himself. He does not conceive himself in the seen. He does not conceive himself apart from the seen. He does not conceive himself to be mine. He does not delight in the seen. Why is that? Because he has fully understood it. So now the practitioner should not conceive himself in the seen, but the enlightened one does not conceive himself in the seen. So here, one is, as a practitioner, one is struggling. We know we shouldn't. We try not to. We're directly perceiving and we're trying not to. But here, there's the potential that it just, the misperception, the of conceiving of self again and again through seeing, hearing, sensing and cognizing is not occurring. It's interesting to see the differences, I think, between an ordinary person, a practitioner, and an arhat and how they perceive. Because the Buddha makes a critical distinction between perceiving something and conceiving of that thing in relationship to I, me, and mine. An enlightened person perceives clearly, understands things as they are, and therefore does not conceive of self in relationship to the experience. The awakened one does not embellish perceptions by fabricating a self. Things are simply known clearly, directly, deeply, intimately, and free of the conceptions of I, me, and mine. Clear perception is free of this distorting influence of selfing, this force of selfing that gives rise to suffering. Now, often we make the mistake, though, of indiscriminately believing our experience, believing what is seen, what is heard, what is sensed, what is cognized, believing our thoughts, without asking ourselves if it's true and can we know it. The mind can so easily fabricate both physical and emotional reactions to things that it conceives of. Our own thoughts, our own stories, our own interpretations and fears. They may or may not be realistic. They may or may not be perceived similarly by anyone else. In fact, sometimes the brain cannot even distinguish between what is a memory of an actual event and what is a memory of a fictional event, a movie that was seen or a book that was read. Sometimes emotions are generated so strongly that they seem almost the same. In fact, it's common for people to get quite worked up emotionally. And very often when people are worked up emotionally, there's actually nothing going on to cause that emotion. Have you noticed that? You know, sometimes just when you're wandering around, you see somebody getting all upset. What's going on? Usually they're sitting comfortably in a room or they're waiting somewhere or they're standing or they're doing something and actually not, it's not like a terribly awful situation that they're physically in and yet there's quite an emotional experience. In fact, most worry, most fretting, obsessive thinking is reacting to nothing other than our own thoughts associated to other thoughts, associated to other thoughts, associated to other thoughts, quite disconnected from what's actually happening in the present moment, in the body, in the room or setting that we're actually in. I have had many embarrassing opportunities to see how my mind misperceives things. And I think we have to take those cherished opportunities to see the fallibility of our own perceptions in order to get a little perspective, to take our own reactions and thoughts with a grain of salt. Some years ago, I was sitting a long retreat, and I was sitting and meditating, right? And I'm aware that I'm feeling some emotion, and the emotions were of some fear and some hostility and resentment, a clear feeling of having been betrayed. And so, you know, I'm mindful of the feeling to some extent, only to some extent, not really very mindful. But I'm aware of the feeling. I'm aware that there is this feeling of betrayal. And the feeling gets quite strong as I'm watching this anger, this sense of betrayal or resentment or hurt build up. And then all of a sudden it dawns on me. There are no Cardassians. I don't know if any of you have watched Star Trek, but in my mind, I was replaying an episode from Star Trek. And the Cardassians are the species that had done some terrible thing to some other species. Some whole planet was destroyed or something, I don't remember what. And I was sitting there in my meditation retreat, replaying this and feeling strong emotion, but I wasn't really aware of what the stimulus was. And here I was, like, quite agitated. And it was just total fiction, like complete and total fiction. There are no Cardassians. So that's a little motto that I remind myself of periodically. I just say, there are no Cardassians. It's not real. It's not real. When I remember that, I know that my mind is so fallible and the emotions built upon thoughts can be completely wrong. And I think we need to catch those moments when we are completely wrong and entangled. Otherwise, it's too easy to invest self in our feelings and emotions, as though we have a right to feel this way, as though, of course, anybody would feel that way. I just remember, there are no Cardassians. And sometimes it's a little slippery when the story is something that seemed to have actually happened in our lives. Then it's more slippery. But when you have an experience of some things that are really off the wall, they can inform you, inform how perception works. And then you realize that even if you're sitting here upset about something that happened last week, that's just as much a fiction. Because open your eyes. What's happening here? This is what's real. Last week is gone. Completely gone. I love the Zen story of the, I don't know if it's a Zen story or some, like, story that's always told of a monk who was an artist and went into the cave. Spent years and years in the cave, and he liked to paint murals on his cave. And he was painting a tiger. And at one point, as he was finishing the tiger, he just put the finishing touches on the eyes of the tiger and stepped back to admire his work, because it was this beautiful tiger on the wall of his cave. And then he went running out of the cave. Why? He was afraid. He thought it was real. Now, we create things that scare us all the time. We create things that worry us. We create things that upset us. And so often, it's actually the workings of our own mind, the patterns and the stories that we're telling ourselves that are upsetting us. We might not want to tell, you know, I don't know if you like to tell, you know, the tradition of telling scary stories to children and then they can't sleep at night. My older sister used to like to tell me scary stories and then I wouldn't be able to sleep at night. I'd be scared. Maybe older sisters often torture younger sisters that way. Maybe a tradition. But sometimes we pick that up in stories that we tell ourselves. We scare ourselves. One of the things I've discovered is that most of the things that we worry about and dwell upon are actually not real. They're not really happening. Even if they happened in the past, or even if we're worried about something that could happen in the future, the fact is both of those are just thoughts, they're fantasies, arising as mental formations, no place other than our own minds. And so we have the opportunity to disidentify with the story, to let it go, and to channel our attention back to the simple experience of the present moment. That might be sitting, it might be breathing. We can reflect then on the process of thought and how we react to our thought worlds, so that we can learn not to be sucked up in the fantasies that are not even real. In this middling discourses number one, the sutta number one, the Buddha makes a very important distinction between perceiving and conceiving. The conceiving is optional. It is optional. We don't have to identify with what is seen, what is heard, what is sensed, what is cognized. We can become mindful of what is seen, what is heard, what is sensed, and what is cognized without taking any of it to be I or me or mine, without building up a sense of self upon that as our foundation. The identification is optional. And when we know this, we realize that suffering is also optional.